From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey, we've got a great show ahead for you today. I hope you all had a good week recovering from Halloween, if you celebrate that holiday, and also All Saints Day, that big solemnity from this past week. Hope it was a wonderful week for all the listeners out there. And we've got a fun show ahead for you today. We'll be talking with a guest that we've spoken with in times in the past. His name is Father Chris Alar. He's from the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. I used to live out in Massachusetts, and I've been to that shrine many times. But Father Chris is a bit of an expert in Eucharistic miracles, and so we're always excited to talk about that topic. But what's particularly interesting is that Father Chris himself was involved in what some say is a potential Eucharistic miracle. So he'll tell us all the details of what happened when he was on a retreat in California, and there were reports of a Eucharistic miracle. We'll find out all about it in just a little bit. And later in the show, we'll be talking about one of the more amazing stories that everybody in the United States knows about. You can say this name, and everybody knows exactly what it's referring to. We're talking about the miracle on the Hudson. Of course, this is from some years ago now, but we're talking about that plane flight that landed in the Hudson River, the first ever aircraft to not be submerged and be destroyed when landing on water. And of course, there was that Tom Hanks movie, Sully, that you might remember from Clint Eastwood some years ago. So it was quite an event. And we're actually today going to be talking with one of the passengers on that flight. His name is Frederick Beretta, and he's the author of a book, My Flight of Faith. It's a classic book out from Tan Books, but we haven't covered this one before on the show, and it's quite an amazing story and a pretty strong Divine Mercy connection as well. So we'll be looking forward to hearing from Fred and his harrowing experience in that miracle on the Hudson. And later in the show, we'll be talking about the 365 Days with Mary project for today's day. We've got the Weeping Virgin from Mariupolcs in Hungary in the year 1696, and the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed Francis de Amboise, who lived in the 1400s in France. And the question of the week, how many Eucharistic miracles have there been? It's a tricky one. I'll try to answer that one in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We talk about miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And for this week, I'd like to give you an update on a potential miracle that was claimed some months ago. You heard it first here on this show, where there was an alleged Eucharistic miracle that was claimed in Thomaston in the Diocese of Hartford, Connecticut. And I got emails and calls from that parish, people who were at the Mass where this alleged miracle supposedly took place. And according to the reports, the priest at the time, in a ciborium that was being used to distribute Holy Communion, there was a case of a Eucharistic miracle of multiplication, where there were hosts that were close to empty in the ciborium, and then at next glance, the ciborium was filled with hosts. And this has been referred to the Vatican for further investigation. The Archdiocese of Hartford is looking into it now, or the Diocese of Hartford is looking to it now. And I just got an email or a communication from that diocese where they said the investigation is still ongoing and we do not have any significant updates to report back. As soon as any sort of determination is made, we will surely send a press release to notify the media, end quote. And so that was from the Diocese of Hartford talking about that alleged miracle in Thomaston. And this was reported in the Washington Post. They interviewed me for that story. And so many people around the world, the United States in particular, were excited about this. Maybe perhaps because there's a Michael McGivney connection, the founder of the Knights of Columbus. That was his old parish there in Thomaston in Connecticut. We'll keep you updated with more miracle news and more updates on that particular Eucharistic miracle that was claimed here in the United States. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that writes in the fastest with the right answer. And last week, we were talking with the Purgatory Lady herself, Susan Tassone. And the question related to purgatory. In what city is the Museum of the Holy Souls in Purgatory located? And that, of course, is in Rome. And it's located in the back of the Chiesa del Sacro Cuore del Suffragio on the banks of the Tiber. It's a tiny centuries-old Piccolo Museo del Purgatorio, Museum of the Holy Souls in Purgatory. It holds a collection of Bibles, prayer books, tabletops, and articles of clothing that have been said to have been singed by the hands of souls in purgatory. So you can see the darkened outline of hands on these various objects as if they were burning them. And writing in with that correct answer was Eliza Doe. Thank you, Eliza, for your response, and you'll be receiving the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. Let's take a look at the question for this week. We're talking, of course, about the miracle on the Hudson. So the question is, for today, who is the patron saint of airplanes? And if you think you know that answer, want to win the prize, send me an email. Again, who is the patron saint of airplanes? And the fastest one with the right answer will win that prize, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on MiracleHunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father Chris Alar about Eucharistic miracles, including an alleged Eucharistic miracle that occurred while he was on retreat in California. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. One of the fun aspects of my job as the Miracle Hunter is I get email from faithful all over the United States and all over the world. And I hear about stories of things being reported, some very interesting things. And we talk a lot about Eucharistic miracles on this show. So I hear the reports of Eucharistic miracles happening all around the world in the United States. And believe it or not, there are some that appear authentic, and there are some that require further investigation. I was just in touch with the Archdiocese of Cincinnati yesterday, and they sent me a release about a Eucharistic miracle that was claimed September 8th. And it was a Eucharistic miracle kind of promoted on social media with not a lot of backing. But it said in a private First Communion Mass in a private home, there was a Eucharistic miracle. And there were some pretty dramatic photos. And I'm just going to read that read that press release. They said, the principal celebrant of the Mass was a visiting priest from the Philippines who had been granted permission to celebrate Mass in a private home. Several attendees of the Mass report some form of manifestation on the substance of the presider's host to have taken place during Mass. It is the understanding of the Archdiocese that the principal celebrant took the host with him when he left Cincinnati following the Mass. The host was never given to Archbishop Dennis M. Schnur. Therefore, the Archdiocese is unable to corroborate anything regarding the authenticity of the alleged miracle. Our Catholic faith teaches us that Jesus Christ is fully and substantially present, body, blood, soul, and divinity, in both the consecrated host and wine, which truly become his body and blood at each celebration of Holy Mass. We continually thank the Lord for the precious gift of the Eucharist and ask him to always increase our faith in the great mystery of his love for us. And that was the statement from the Archdiocese of Cincinnati related to an alleged Eucharistic miracle that happened on September 8th. So various things are being claimed throughout the world, and there was another Eucharistic miracle that was reported. We saw this on social media and otherwise, and it was related to Father Chris Alar, who's joining us today. You all know him for his presence on EWTN and, of course, at the National Shrine of Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And he had an experience that he reported in a homily, and that's being picked up in the Catholic blogosphere and otherwise. And we're so excited to talk to him today about what happened. Welcome to the program today, Father Chris.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's an honor to be with you again. We appreciate having you on our EWTN show as well. So thank you for returning the favor of spreading our Catholic faith.
Absolutely. The back and forth is wonderful. And so what's very interesting to me, of course, is that people who can tune into your homilies, which shed great light on the teachings and the miracles of the Church, you've been putting a special emphasis on Eucharistic miracles yourself, perhaps,
yes,
in recent times as related to the Eucharistic revival. Because as we discussed, this is so important for people to know the reality of these events, and they can really bolster our faith and our belief in the real presence. So they're truly, yes, important. And so it's quite exciting and interesting that you yourself had an experience being a person who likes to talk about Eucharistic miracles. You were on a retreat and you had some experience or something was witnessed in your presence. Tell us a little bit about the backstory of what happened.
Yes, I was invited out to California outside of San Francisco and a little ways outside of San Francisco, which we all know is an area in need of prayer. And I was there as the main giving of a retreat. The priest there was invited in to give a retreat. And what the retreat was on was Mary and the Eucharist, and the importance of both Mary, the Eucharist, and the connection between the two. And so I had never really done a specific retreat. I've done retreats on Mary. I've done retreats on the Eucharist. I've done retreats on Divine Mercy. I've done the retreats on the sacraments. But to really pull together the connection between Mary and the Eucharist, this was a first. And so I did a series of talks that weekend, which was October 13th, and I had spoken about, as you just mentioned, Michael, the importance of the Eucharist, and of course, I did some talking on Eucharistic miracles. Now, I adhered to just Vatican-approved miracles and what they are telling us, which is fascinating in and of itself, and then I smiled because I left when it was reported that there had been an image of Our Lady that had appeared to some of those who had been in adoration. And I've claimed from the beginning that this is not anything that I know is either supernatural or natural. I cannot claim that this has been approved. It is not. Is to my knowledge, has not been looked at by the bishop. It's not been at all, declared miraculous. But what I find is very interesting is it's very clear that we can see the Blessed Mother there. Now, the question is she actually on the host or on a reflection of the glass? Mm. And I find this very interesting because while there is an image of Our Lady in the back of the church of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and if you look at the image that has been reported, you can see there is a connection there. It does resemble, when you further look at it, Our Lady of Guadalupe. But here is what's fascinating to me. Two things. One, if it was a reflection, the statue of Mary is in the far, far back of the church and way off to the side. So she's at an angle. Now, I have an engineering degree. I know about optics. I know about angles and physics. If you are to see a reflection, if it was just a reflection of a supernatural, I'm sorry, of natural order, you'd have to be offset from in front of the monstrance at that same angle to the opposite side to be able to see the reflection of the statue that was in the very back of the church to the other side. And the thing was that people were seeing it straight in front of the monstrance. And what's also unique is Mary in that image, let's not say she was on the Eucharist, let's not say she was on the glass, we don't know, because I had left, or I had just left, and I laughed. I said Mary had to wait till after I left to be able to perform the miracle because I still need work to do on Father Chris, but what I found interesting was Mary filled the entire monstrance. Now, this is a very large monstrance. I'm guessing close to a foot in diameter. It was huge, and Mary filled the entire thing. This statue of Mary was in the very, very back of the church. If you were seeing a reflection, which, again, I am not denying that it wasn't a reflection, I am not. It very well may be. But let's say it was a reflection. I think even in that, there is some supernatural or miraculous elements. Why? Because if that was simply a reflection of the back of the church, Mary would have been very small in that image. Because if you're going to see a reflection of the whole back of the church, it's not going to zoom in. Reflections don't have the ability to zoom in. They're going to show you a reflection of the back of the church, and you would have seen the doors, you would have seen the walls, you would have seen But no, it was the entire reflection of Mary. And if it is a reflection, many believe it was actually her on the Eucharist. But even if it was a reflection, it's very odd that she was that large, because having had classes in physics and optics, the angle would not have allowed her to be that big due to the distance she was away. So the image of Mary would have been much smaller. The other fascinating thing, as I mentioned about the angle, but we just received a photo from a woman who was there at that moment, and she thought that was the most beautiful monstrance she ever saw. The monstrance is close to 6 feet tall. And she was taking pictures of it during adoration. She was sitting in a pew in front of the monstrance. And so she took a picture, and her pictures actually have time stamps. So she took a series of pictures from the exact same spot in the exact same pew from the exact same angle. And her picture at 9:28 p.m. had no image of Mary. Her picture at 9:48 p.m. had no picture of Mary. Her picture at, like, she had like three, and then one at like 9:58 had no image of Mary. Then all of a sudden, her picture at exactly 10 o'clock p.m. at that same angle, all of a sudden now you have the image of Mary. So my point is, I'm not denying it's a reflection. It may very well be, but why would those reflections not have shown in the first three pictures? You know, they didn't show, but in that last series, after that certain amount of time, then all of a sudden it started to appear. And so I found that very intriguing, because if somebody would have said, well, maybe it was the sun moving, and then the sun at that moment gave the reflection, well, no, it was 10 o'clock at night. And so there was no sun. You had the same light reflection from the inside lights at 10 p.m. as you did at 9:48 p.m. And so these are all, again, we can't determine if it was supernatural or natural. We can't determine. The bishop has not, to my knowledge, made any statement on this. But whatever God gave us here, I think it was a beautiful gift. Because even if it was a reflection, you had to let even suppose it was, if Mary was on the glass. One person wrote me a beautiful note and said, well, Father, even if it was Mary's reflection on the glass, he's showing us to Jesus through Mary. and you had to look through the glass of Mary to see Jesus. But I tell you, Michael, I'm not opposed to believing it wasn't Mary on the Eucharist, and somebody called that claim blasphemous. And I said, not really, because you and I know from all the Eucharistic miracles that the ones tested our human heart tissue. And if anything, what if Mary was on that image of the Eucharist, could God be showing us, could Jesus be showing us that Our Lady is in his heart? Because that is really what the Eucharist is. It's human heart tissue. It's the heart of our Lord.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Chris Ehler, who had an experience of something some might call a miracle and others might say it's a reflection, but either way, it was inspirational to those people who witnessed this manifestation. We may never know what it is, but certainly it's something worth talking about. And of course, this leads into a larger discussion on Eucharistic miracles, because I think throughout history, we don't see any cases like this of an image. Perhaps there was one in India where there was an image of Christ that was claimed to form on a host. But by and large, when we talk about Eucharistic miracles, especially the ones testable by science, we're talking about those cases that you, Father Chris, referenced, these cases where human flesh and human blood is made manifest on a consecrated host and is testable by science. Now, of course, I was talking about this on your show, and now you're talking about it on mine, so we're going back and forth a little bit. But when you talk about Eucharistic miracles and present these great events to the faithful, how many cases are we talking about here throughout Christian history?
Yeah, there's been hundreds, if not thousands, reported. But currently, I've been following the 120 that we really refer to as Vatican-approved, Eucharistic miracles that are being translated into, for instance, the English that gave us, and we know some of the classic Lanciano and others that we have in the history of our church, by faith and by tradition, have held that these are special occurrences of supernatural origin. And you know, Michael, as you know, they all share the same scientific elements.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think for people who don't know, and of course, in this time of Eucharistic revival, we're talking more about Eucharistic miracles, which is great. But what are some of these points of correspondence between samples all around the world that they have some kind of elements in common? What are those?
Yes, absolutely fascinating. We do entire talks on this, and I know you do as well, and it's so beautiful for us to come together on this, because looking at some of the most common elements, I think the blood type is one. When many Eucharistic miracles were first reported centuries ago, they didn't even know about blood type.
That's right.
You know, if somebody was going to do a hoax, how did they always get AB positive blood to be, you know, AB blood type to be the blood of the Eucharistic miracles? And how beautiful that every bleeding host has been tested, has been shown to have that, which is uniquely the universal receiver, not the universal donor, which we may, would uncommon sense-wise, think that Christ donated his blood to us, gave his blood, spilled his blood, but actually it's the universal receiver. Why? Because if you are the universal receiver, you can take the blood from anyone and bring them into your body. What happens at Holy Communion? The body of Christ, and he takes everyone into his body. He receives us. We always think about, I receive Jesus at Holy Communion. Really, it's about the body of Christ receiving you. You're being united into the body of Christ. And that makes perfect sense why he is the universal receiver. And these blood types are amazing. In fact, they've been shown that they have coagulated on the outside, but yet on the inside, the blood is fresh. Even on Eucharistic miracles hundreds of years old, they continue to effuse fresh blood, which is impossible because it's separate from a living organism, but yet fresh blood continues to effuse from these. And to me, one of the most fascinating is they have white blood cells. All the ones tested have white blood cells, which scientists tell us is impossible for white blood cells to live outside of a living organism for more than something like, I think, 20 minutes or something like that, that they would not exist. Well, these all have living white blood cells, which shows that the sample is living. It's alive, and in all of them, tested came from the human heart, the myocardium, the cross-striated muscle of the human heart. And the beautiful, not beautiful, but unique thing to it is all the samples tested appeared to come from somebody whose heart was under severe stress. And what did our Lord endure in the Passion? Obviously, severe stress. So these things are fascinating on the commonality between all of these Eucharistic miracles.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Chris Aylar about Eucharistic miracles. And in my opinion, this type of miracle is, I study them all when we're talking about incorruptible saints and Marian mm-hmm. apparitions and stigmata and all these weeping statues and strange and fascinating things in our Catholic faith that we all find so interesting and hopefully inspirational, leading us towards Christ. But with Eucharistic miracles, we see an invitation to science to validate that. And it's our job to present these results to the world. And so during this time of Eucharistic revival, I think Eucharistic miracles are so important to talk about. And we're so grateful to you, Father Chris, for telling us about these various points of correspondence. And for me personally, I really like in these Eucharistic miracles how on a microscopic level, they see a complete integration between what was bread and now what is shown to be true flesh. And they cannot see where one starts and one ends. It's completely intermeshed, intertwined, and it's completely unfakeable. There's no process. There's no science. There's no way to do it. So I think that for me, when we're talking about what about a hoax, there can't be a hoax.
No.
When we talk about the lack of knowledge of blood types dating way back when, and also this on this microscopic level. It's absolutely amazing. So, Father Chris, going forward, as people can tune into your podcast, tell people where they can find it, or your broadcast of your masses, your homilies. They're so inspirational. Tell people where they can find you.
Oh, yes. So please join us as we continue. You, Michael, work together with us on EWTN. You can always see our EWTN show called Living Divine Mercy, which is on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. on EWTN. But also our own platform, Divine Mercy Plus, spelled out P-L-U-S, so DivineMercyPlus.org, has our masses, rosary, chaplets, and our talks. A lot of, like you, we talk about these miracles and Our Lady. And, you know, one last miracle, if I may, Michael, mention is I'm doing some research myself to find the scientific background of it, but a lot of reports that the blood that's tested is, you know, we all know the XY chromosomes. You know, the mother supplies always an X, and the father, if he supplies an X, you have a girl, two X's is a girl. And if he supplies a Y, you have an X and a Y, you have a boy. Supposedly, in many of these miracles, there's no Y chromosome. There's only an X, which would mean a human mother, but no earthly father. And I always found that to be very fascinating as well. So much to think about in the beauty of our faith on a supernatural level.
Absolutely. I think the science on this is so important that we get it out and have it be completely vetted and presented in a way that people of faith and not of faith can really grapple with what we're dealing with Eucharistic miracles. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father Chris Ahlar, for joining us on today's program and for sharing your experience of a possible Eucharistic miracle and also the beauty of Eucharistic miracles in our Catholic Church. Thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you to you and your listeners as well. God bless you.
God bless. That was Father Chris Ahlar from the National Shrine of Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, an amazing place. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. I love getting your questions via email. And also when I'm giving a talk, I travel around the country and maybe give 20 talks a year at different parishes, conferences, shrines. And been giving a lot of talks on Eucharistic miracles this time, during this time of Eucharistic revival. People have questions about Eucharistic miracles, and I try to answer them. I talk for about 45 minutes, and then I do a Q&A session afterwards. And it's always fun to hear what people are thinking about. And hopefully, I have the right answer. So the question for this week is, how many Eucharistic miracles have there been? Thank you, Jim. Well, Jim writes in with that question, and it's a tricky question because we might say, well, what in fact is the definition of a Eucharistic miracle? We'll be talking today with Father Chris Ahlar about a Eucharistic miracle that was claimed in California, where we talk about an image maybe appearing on a host. We also talked about just a moment ago those miracles, that the miracle in Thomaston, Connecticut, where we saw the multiplication of hosts in a ciborium. And so there are various types of Eucharistic miracles throughout history. We talk about those cases where hosts have been spared of a fire or a disaster. We have cases where we might see some strange phenomena, some light, some levitation. We've also seen cases of strange stained images on the host, perhaps the face of Christ or the face of Christ on a on the altar cloth when wine spills. We have various types of Eucharistic miracles, and you might know the name Blessed Carlo Acutis. He was a young man who died of leukemia and had a great devotion to the Eucharist and a great fascination with Eucharistic miracles. And he built a website, and now the Real Presence organization, therealpresence.org, has all his work posted there. So people can go and find out about all these Vatican-recognized Eucharistic miracles throughout history. And then so in his display or his collection of Vatican-recognized Eucharistic miracles, and again, these are all different types. These are types of these related to saints in Edia, saints who survived on the Eucharist alone. And we're also talking about these most dramatic, in my opinion, types of Eucharistic miracles where true flesh and true blood is made manifest on a consecrated host. And so when we look at his number, we see a number something like 120 all around the world of these various types. When we talk about Eucharistic miracles of this blood and flesh type, the number is much smaller, perhaps something around 20. And so my new program that they'll be coming out next year called Miracles of the Eucharist, I go to the places of the five greatest scientifically tested places. I'll be going to Lanciano and Legnica and Sokolka in Poland and Tixla in Mexico and Buenos Aires in Argentina. And I'll be presenting the science on all of those cases. So stay tuned for that coming out in a mini-series in July of next year called Miracles of the Eucharist. But thanks, Jim, for your question. It's a little bit of a tricky one. It depends on how you define it. There are different ways of looking at Eucharistic miracles, but whatever ones you look at, they all inspire our faith and draw us closer to Christ. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We do that every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day of the week. And of course, we know Fatima on May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year. And for today, we have the Weeping Virgin, the Mariupolx from Hungary in 1696. And to celebrate his release in 1696 from his captivity as a prisoner of a war by the Turks, Laszlo Ciri commissioned a wooden icon of the Virgin Child in his hometown of Polx in Hungary. On November 4th, the icon began to lacrimate, its cry, and when a priest held up a dying child to those tears, the child was miraculously healed. And starting on December 8th, the icon wept for another 2 weeks. Polx became renowned as Mariupolx. Maria, put at the front of that name, at the order of the Emperor Leopold II in February 1697, the miraculous image was transferred to St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna. To this day, the image resides in a chapel to the right of the entrance. Later, a reproduction was gifted by the emperor to the church in Mariupolx, and that one wept three times itself in 1715, 1750, and 1905. And so that is the Weeping Virgin Mariupolx, Hungary, in the year 1696. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com or connect to the Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary and join any of the 10,000 followers who get a Marian title on their Facebook page each and every day. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We talk a lot about saints and future saints on the show, and of course we're talking about those servants of God, venerable, blessed, and saints, those people who need more miracles before they're formally recognized as a saint by Rome. And this connects with my book, They Might Be Saints, which is available at EWTNRC.com, and my television show, They Might Be Saints, which airs every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. And so for today's day, we have the Might Be Saint of the Day. Today is Blessed Francis d'Amboise, who lived from 1427 to 1485 in France. And she was the daughter of Louis d'Amboise, the Viscount of Thouars, and she grew up in the court of Brittany. She was the Duchess of Brittany, being married to Peter II, Duke of Brittany, at the age of 15. And she was betrothed to him at the age of 4. It was not a happy marriage, and Peter sometimes abused her, but Francis softened Peter over the years and worked for the canonization of St. Vincent Ferrer. She supported the Dominican convent at Nantes, and she was widowed in 1457 and then devoted herself to religious life, joining the Carmelite nuns at Bondon in 1468, making her final vows the next year. And she was a spiritual student of Blessed John Soreth, and she worked in the infirmary for a while and was elected prioress for life in 1473, and she's considered the foundress of the Carmelite nuns in France. And again, she was born in 1427. She died in 1485 on November 4th at Les Quatre Nantes in France of natural causes. While in a religious ecstasy, miracles were reported at her tomb, and her body had to be moved to save it during the Huguenot Wars and again during the French Revolution. She was beatified by Pope Pius IX on July 16th, 1863. One more miracle will move Blessed Francis d'Amboise to become Saint Francis. More information on her can be found at theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Frederick Beretta, a man who was on the flight of faith, as he calls it, and he was a passenger on that plane that landed in the miracle of the Hudson. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill on the Miracle Hunter. Some years ago now, but everybody remembers this. This is a story from January 15th, 2009, popularly called The Miracle on the Hudson. You may have even seen that Clint Eastwood film called Sully, where Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger made the historic emergency landing, a water landing on the Hudson River. And it's an incredible story, and we might want to talk about the details of that event. Maybe we never want to stop talking about this, because as far as I know, it is the one and only time in the history of aviation that there's been a successful water landing where everybody on board survived. And so we're so excited today to talk with one of the passengers on that flight. He was in a business trip in New York City. His name is Fred Beretta, and he wrote a book, My Flight of Faith, from Tan Books. It's a classic book now. It's been out for some years, but it's a story that can always be told. And I love the idea that there was some connection to divine mercy as we saw that plane land safely in the Hudson. We're so grateful to welcome to the show today, Fred Beretta.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Fred. This was an exciting story, and I know for you it's a traumatic one, remembering it in interviews like this or talking to people, and you're part of a select group of people who had the true bird's-eye view, you were part of the real experience of this event on January 15th, 2009. Let's start it up. What was your day like that day? Perhaps it was a day like any other, but let me know what went into getting to that plane.
Pretty normal day. I headed to the airport from New York into LaGuardia to fly home to Charlotte, where I live. And it was a beautiful, clear day. No clouds, but extremely cold, about 22 degrees. Boarded the flight around 3:15 p.m. Everything was normal. Took off. Relaxed in my seat. And about 3,000 feet above the ground, there was a kind of explosion. The plane shook violently, and I knew, of course, something was dreadfully wrong. Now, I'm a private pilot, so I know something about aviation, and my inclination was that the left engine had somehow sheared off the plane. So that's that's when it all began.
And so, of course, any person to have that kind of rumbling feeling on a plane is going to gulp. And you, with your past aviation experience, we're worried about what was going to happen next. How did the crew and the pilot react in either in the announcement overhead or the preparation for what was going to happen next?
Well, there was complete silence, and I've been in a lot of turbulence and flying around the world. This was enormously different. This was the clear sound of something impacting the engines. And there was really no talk. People were a bit stunned. Captain Sully leveled the plane, dipped the nose a little bit to keep up airspeed, and flew straight on. And then he started to bank to the left and turn back around where I thought he was going to go to LaGuardia, but of course he wouldn't make that, so he did not go there.
And what did people begin to do on that plane when they assumed that that things were headed in the wrong direction? I'm sure people got into the position for impact, but then you probably had people like yourself praying and hoping for some kind of miraculous outcome. Where did your mind go at this time?
Well, once we squared up over the Hudson, he lowered the flaps. I knew exactly what he was doing. Most of the passengers did not. Then about 500 feet above the ground, he made the call that any captain would be required to make in a situation like that. And he said, "This is the captain, brace for impact." That's all that he said. And at that point, people were very stunned. The flight attendants started shouting, heads down, brace. And at that point, there was some crying. There was some praying. There were people frantically trying to call their loved ones. It wasn't chaos, but certainly that angst was going on for sure.
And for you?
I was trying to process it mostly. I could see the left engine from my window, and it had imploded, and fire was coming out of the exhaust cone. But I thought that the right engine must be working. I called down to the man that was in opposite to me in seat 16F, and I asked him if he could see the engine and if it was working, and he shook his head no. And at that point, I knew we were in deep, deep trouble.
And how did you cope with this, knowing that your death was imminent?
First, I processed the chances of survival from some of my aviation studies. I thought it might be 50-50, and I was pretty close. Once I did that, I thought about my family and, you know, how I didn't want it to end this way. And then the third thing is I had prayed the Divine Mercy Chaplet, ironically, the day before. It's a prayer that I knew, but I hadn't prayed it in months. And for some reason, I prayed it the day before. And I remember the image of Christ on the front. And I just fixated on that image. And I remembered the promise in the 3 o'clock hour that he made to Faustina that nothing would be refused. I don't know why I remembered that, but I did. So I kept that image in my mind, and I started to say a few prayers. And I reached a point where I could see the water coming up. We were getting closer. There was ice in the water. And I had this decision, a choice to make. It's hard to describe the dread and the fear that you feel in that situation. And it was pressing my body down into the seat. I had no energy in my body, but my mind was extremely alert. So I had this, I'm fighting this great dread and fear. But there was something else compelling me to let go and to trust in God. That seemed impossible to me. But I remembered the words, and I made the decision, and I said, "God, it's okay," and it's okay. So that was where I was at that moment, and then just watching the water approach.
And when you crashed into the water, were you shocked that the plane didn't go under, or that you were still coasting along like a boat at some point?
The impact was quite tremendous. We bounced twice. My head hit the tray table of the seat in front of me, and my head cracked the knob that keeps that tray table up, which is made of solid plastic. Then we started to slow, careened a little bit, and then we were floating. And all you could hear was the sound of water coming down the fuselage. It was almost like a waterfall. And I was amazed the plane was intact. I was very appreciative of that at that moment, for sure.
And the looks on the faces of the people on the plane, do you remember that?
Quiet, stunned, complete shock. It kicked in when the flight attendants stood up. They commanded the passengers near the exit doors to exit through the exit doors. they started to do that. And then we, of course, were all very orderly. We knew when our time came to leave our seat, we had to do it rather expeditiously.
And water was entering the aircraft at this point, right? Freezing cold winter water, right?
It's coming in through the back door, yes. But fortunately, it wasn't gushing in, but it was coming in precipitously. And so when my time came, I was in the window seat. It was very difficult to get the life preserver from under my seat. So I tried, and I didn't want to hold up anyone, so I just exited onto the wing without my life jacket.
And you and the rest of the however many passengers that was, 150 or more, all survived, correct? Everybody made it to safety.
Absolutely. That's why it's a miracle. That's why they call it a miracle. There were was one passenger that or a flight attendant had a bad gash in her leg. And there were two or three at least that had hypothermia because they were in the water. The water was as cold as the water would have been around the Titanic. It was probably in the mid to upper, 38 degrees. You could only survive in that for 10 minutes or so. Fortunately, they were able to get out of there. And that was the worst of it.
And when you landed, when you got to safety, when you called your wife, when you were with your family again, what was going through your mind?
Well, I got on the ferry boat. The ferry boat came and rescued us and took us to the terminal. And I called my wife. I said, she had just been picking up our children at school. I said I had been in a plane crash in the Hudson River, but I'm okay. My wife knows that I have a little bit of a sense of humor, and she thought I was kidding. And I said, no, go turn on the television. So she did that, and there it was. CNN was recording it. So
we're talking with Fred Beretta, one of the passengers on the flight for the Miracle of the Hudson. He is author of the book My Flight of Faith with Tan Books. And did you ever look at your watch as the plane was going down?
But I knew when we took off, and I didn't know the exact time we hit the water, but it was 3:31 p.m.
And of course, 3:30 is considered the great hour of mercy. Perhaps there's some connection there. And so when you got home, and perhaps you never get over this sort of a thing, perhaps it still replays in your mind all the time and people ask you about it. What did you do to tell other people, perhaps tell them about your faith and how you prayed? Who did you get in touch with to tell them about what happened?
Well, when I was in the ferry boat terminal, I was walking around very cold and they gave us coffee. And many of the passengers at that point were crying, some on the floor, some kind of in a catatonic state. I just kept pacing around drinking coffee, and a CNN reporter came up to me and he asked me if I would speak to Wolf Blitzer, and I didn't remember who Wolf Blitzer was.
Sure.
I said, okay. So he gave me his BlackBerry, and then I was live on the air with Wolf Blitzer. I think I was the first passenger interviewed, or certainly the second. So then that led to another interview, and Fox News invited me on their Sunday morning show after the crash, and I came on that show, and it was interesting because at some point, I don't know how they knew this, but I must have told someone that told them. They said, you prayed the St. Michael prayer while you were crashing. Why did you do that? And I said, well, in my faith, in the Catholic faith, it's a traditional prayer for protection. So I prayed that prayer, and I made it about halfway through before we hit the water. And then that singular comment developed interest in the Catholic world. So I had some priests reach out to me, parishes, and I've spoken maybe 20 times. I was invited to speak at the Atlanta Eucharistic Conference. some years ago, and people had an interest in it. And if it's of value to people, I'm happy to share the story.
And what did you walking away from this? What did you learn, or what was the lesson, or what was the takeaway for you for this unbelievable experience?
Many people ask me that question, and I'm not sure that they're satisfied with the answer. Principally, it was a lesson in two things. One, humility. I realized that I had zero control of my life. I thought I had control. I was a successful business executive with many people reporting to me. And I realized I had absolutely no control of my life, that God was in complete control. And that segued into the second most important piece, which was trust. So I thought I trusted in God. And then that was a great test because of that decision I had to make and the impossibility of letting go, believing that it was my time, believing if I let go, I was going to die. So it was a great lesson in trust. Absolutely. That's the key lesson. And that is a key part of Faustina's diary. You know, Jesus, I trust in you. So it was very interesting to me.
Absolutely. And as you reflect back on this and you look at perhaps some sort of divine mercy connection, I know you contacted the shrine there, the National Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, and you told them about your flight 1549. When you did contact them and told them about it, what was the response to the idea that perhaps it was some sort of divine mercy connection for you, that prayer before, or that trust, as Faustina says? What was the reaction there at that shrine?
Well, actually, one of the priests heard about this story and invited me to speak at a parish in Orlando, and I met him, and then he invited me up to Stockbridge, and then I spoke up there. And I think the message there was well received, the divine mercy, because, of course, that's a very big part of what they promote. And I was happy to share the story. So, yeah, I think it resonated very well with them.
Absolutely. Well, we're so grateful to you, Fred Beretta, for joining us on today's program, talking about the miracle on the Hudson, your incredible survival on that flight that you probably shouldn't have survived. And we're so grateful that you're still telling the story of how your faith got you through it and for the lessons that's learned. People can pick up your book, My Flight of Faith, from Tan Books, which is tanbooks.com. Thank you so much, Fred, for joining us on today's show.
Thank you.
God bless. That was Fred Beretta, author of My Flight of Faith from Tan Books and survivor of that flight crash, The Miracle on the Hudson. Absolutely amazing story. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio and check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Father Chris Alar from the National Shrine of Divine Mercy in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, talking to us about Eucharistic miracles, and Frederick Beretta, the author of My Flight of Faith from Tan Books, about being on that incredible miracle of the Hudson flight. Check out Explore with the Miracle Hunter, San Giovanni Rotondo. It's the one that covers Padre Pio, the great miracle-working saint, a journey to Italy to meet the man known worldwide for healing miracles by location and exhibiting the wounds of Christ in the stigmata. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at ewtnrc.com. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.